Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Charlie Ebinger, the director of the Energy Security Initiative here at Brookings. On behalf of ESI and the Northeast Asia Program, we're delighted to have you join us today on a very important topic. I think this meeting could not occur at a better time or a more interesting time in the future of both the nuclear power industry and the non-proliferation regime. We, of course, in response largely to climate change concerns around the world, we have people rethinking the nuclear option as one that does not contribute to CO2 emissions in the atmosphere, and yet at the same time, that very changed atmosphere, which portends good things for the industry, comes along with growing concerns in some circles about whether the world is really ready to have a major expansion in commercial nuclear power in terms of concerns about non-proliferation, nuclear proliferation, especially as more third world countries, and some of which are in very inhospitable areas of the world, are beginning to pursue the atomic power option. It's also a very interesting time because we have a raging debate going on in the country and the world about the adequacy of uranium supplies, with some analysts saying there's absolutely no constraint on uranium supplies until well after 2100, and other people taking grave exception to that, arguing that the cost of bringing on major new uranium mines around the world, which are estimated roughly at $1.5 billion, portend potential shortages or at least disruptions in the market, and I hope we may have an opportunity to get into some of those issues today. Likewise, with concern about energy security always on the forefront of the international agenda, we have a raging debate on the wisdom of closing the nuclear fuel cycle as countries look at reprocessing facilities and or acquiring their own uranium enrichment facilities. So we have a debate that will obviously be pronounced in the NPT review conference next April about whether we should try to multilateralize enrichment and reprocessing, the merits or demerits of that argument. And, of course, we also have the question of the future of the non-proliferation treaty regime in itself, with many countries, including Iran, arguing that under Article 4 they should have the right to the full fuel cycle. And, of course, the United States and other powers taking a very different view. So against that backdrop, we look forward to a very lively discussion. And before we get underway, I want to invite Mr. Ishwashita to the program. He is the professor and director of the Slavic Research Center at Hokkaido University, and he wants to make some few remarks.
Thank you. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and distinguished guests. It is my great pleasure and honor to be here at Brookings Institution once again to host the second joint forum co-sponsored by our Slavic Research Center at Hokkaido University and the Center for the Northeast Asian Policy Studies here at the Brookings. Please allow me to take this time to thank the Brookings Institution, particularly my good friend Kevin Scott and Dr. Shoichi Ito here now, the SINAPS visiting fellow, and for their support and cooperation to provide this opportunity to invite experts to share the thoughts and expertise on today's theme, Nuclear Renaissance and U.S.-Japan Alliance. It was only May 8th of this year when the Slavic Research Center and the SINAPS had our very first groundbreaking joint forum here on the U.S.-Japan Alliance beyond Northeast Asia, where we invited experts from U.S. foreign policy communities on Northeast Asia, not only on Northeast Asia, Russia, China, Central Asia, Middle East, South Asia, and even Europe, to not only discuss the reshaping the Japan's interest in U.S. foreign policy, but also to reconfirm Japan's commitment in those areas. I had made it clear then, but I will say that once again here, joint forum to bring together expertise from various areas, various study areas to address common concerns that surround and affect us today, and to move toward direction for constructive and rational deliberation to advocate and promote more sound foreign policies are not only important for the United States and Japan, but also the international community as a whole. It is our responsibility to continue this joint venture. The world has witnessed a historical moment for nuclear weapons disarmament, the United States, President Obama's declaration in Prague. However, while continuous commitment for nuclear weapons disarmament is imperative, so is a bigger discussion and cooperation on nuclear energy source. To quote President Obama, we should build a new framework for civil nuclear cooperation, including an international fuel bank, so that countries can access peaceful power without increasing the risk of proliferation. We are gathered today here to consider the possibility of a plausible framework to facilitate the peaceful use of nuclear power, I think. The significance and impact of this forum are obvious. To build the present world again, together we can do it. As director of the Slavic Research Center, allow me to end with few words on our current project at the center. We have just launched the Global Center of Excellence Program on Reshaping Japan's Border Studies. Maybe you look at this, the symbol of globes. The objective of this project is to bring together area studies experts from not only Slavic and Eurasian regions, but from other regions in the international community to consider all kind of border-related issues and topics. Nuclear issues are also in our border study project. This project is in line with our ongoing mission to establish a new methodology to compare similar phenomena that transcend the current segregated area studies discourse to promote peace and stability around the world. This joint forum, to a certain degree, is one of our initiatives for this mission. Part of this forum has been partly founded by this project. I'd like to extend my invitation to experts here today join us this mission. I look forward to your continued support and future collaboration. Thank you again to the Brookings Institution and the invited guests and audience that have made this joint forum possible. Thank you very much.
If I could get our first panel to come on up. We are very fortunate today to have both our panels comprise some of the leading nuclear energy experts from both the United States and Japan. So I hope we can have a very stimulating discussion. You have detailed biographies on the handout, so I'll just make brief introductions. On our first panel, we have Dr. Suzuki, who is a senior research scientist at the Socioeconomic Research Center, which is part of the Central Research Institute of the Electric Power Industry in Japan. He is a distinguished professor with a long list of publications in the nuclear energy field. I'm particularly interested to see that he works with the Institute of Energy Economics, which, to show how old I am, I had the privilege of doing a book some 25 years ago. It's nice to have a new connection again with your institution. And we also have Dr. Charles Ferguson, who is well known in the nuclear energy and nonproliferation field. Charles is with the Council on Foreign Relations. He's an adjunct professor at Georgetown University. And his vast array of writings in many fields include expertise in arms control, climate change, energy policy and nuclear and other international terrorism. A man of truly Catholic interests, we're delighted he can join us here today. So I would urge, so we have plenty of time for questions, if at all possible, that maybe you each speak for 20 minutes, and then we'll have adequate time for questions. So Dr. Suzuki.
Okay, thank you. Good morning. I should start with this. I think this is it. Yes. Okay. Thank you very much. My talk is on global trends of international nuclear market and particularly issues for Japan. And since the time is limited, I will focus on key issues. And let's quickly go over what's the status of nuclear power right now. This is the numbers that you want to remember. At the end of April 2009, which is somewhat the same, 436 reactors, the total capacity is 370 gigawatts, and about 80% of the capacity is in OECD countries still. But if you look at the numbers under construction, 60% of the new construction is in Asia. When you say Asia, it's basically Japan, South Korea, and China, and now India are coming. So those four countries are the main country who are planning to increase the number of nuclear power plants. And many other countries who want to introduce nuclear power, I will introduce later, but it's in terms of capacity. Those are the four countries dominant in the next 10, 20 years. And about 60% of the power production, global production, come from nuclear power. So remember these numbers, 60% and 370 gigawatts. They are key numbers to remember. And this is the past nuclear power growth. And as you can see, the rapid growth in 70s, 80s, but in the 90s, almost flat. Maybe it's hard to see, but it's the power production is still increasing even though the capacity of nuclear power remains flat, which means that the capacity factor, utilization factor of nuclear power is improving. And this trend will continue, hopefully. Even if you cannot build a new nuclear power plant, you can still increase the power production of nuclear power. That is a good thing for energy and the environment. But if you look at this number, as I said, the share of nuclear power, global nuclear share, is only 60%. And if you don't do anything, the share of nuclear power will decline. Let's say at the bottom. Do you have any point? Can you see this 50% right now to decline? If you don't do anything, by 2030, the share will decline 10%, particularly in OECD Europe. The share will decline from 28% to 12%. So if the share declines, then you have to burn something else for power production, and most likely fossil fuel, maybe some renewable energies. But it's likely that the carbon dioxide emission will increase. So in order to keep the power growth of the demand in all the world, you want to maintain the share of nuclear power. So OECD is suggesting you have to maintain the share of 40%, then you have to build more power plants. And probably roughly 1.5 times the power demand will increase. So that's the goal of nuclear power, in order to meet the energy demand from particularly the developing countries. The reason why the share will decrease is that the reactor is getting old. When you build the reactor 1780s, the average lifetime, let's say 40 years, then you have to retire many reactors before 2025. According to this estimate done by Michael Schneider and his group, by 2025, 260 reactors and 225 gigawatt need to be replaced. So those number itself, they're very good numbers for nuclear industry. We have to build those reactors. In order to meet those demands, you need a big capacity for build up a nuclear power. If you don't do that, the share will decrease. So that's the status of nuclear market right now. Further, By 2050, how much reactor you need? This is a good number to remember also. MIT did a study in 2003, and by 2050, the total nuclear capacity should reach about 1,000 gigawatts. You remember 370 gigawatts is the current number. So it's roughly three times nuclear power you need by 2050. So even if you increase this share, I mean, if you increase three times, the global nuclear share is roughly same, a little bit increase, 2% increase also. So OECD, IEA also suggested even bigger than this, 1,250 gigawatts to meet the climate change target to reduce CO2 by 50% by 2050. So that's the number you want to remember. If you want to increase the nuclear power to meet the climate change challenge, you have to increase about three times as nuclear power in the world. So that's a big challenge for nuclear industry because in the past, it was very difficult to do that. In the 1970s, IAEA, International Atomic Energy Agency, predicted by 1990, it will reach the global nuclear capacity will reach by 1,000 gigawatts. It never reached, of course. In 1977, it says by 2000, it will reach almost 1,400 gigawatts. And even 1982, they expect to increase, they projected by 1,000 gigawatts by 2010. It never realized. And 2001, they just thought that the capacity will be flat. It's more realistic. Now, IAEA is projecting roughly 600 gigawatts by 2030. That's the number we are hoping to reach to meet the climate change challenge. So this is a expectation and high expectation in the past, but it wasn't that easy to reach that target. So it's a big challenge for nuclear industry. All right. Then I'm going to talk about issues for Japan. Basically three things. One is the changing global nuclear energy market, industry market. This is a very interesting time. And also, Japan is more active in nuclear diplomacy. And finally, talk about spent fuel management, which is a big issue for non-proliferation. In Japan, in the reactor, there are two types of reactor currently in the world. Basically, PWR, pressurized water reactor, and boiling water reactor, PWR. In Japan, the market almost split. GE, Toshiba, Hitachi was supplying PWR. Westinghouse and Mitsubishi is supplying PWR. But the global market is a little bit different. 80% of the capacity is PWR. So in the future, what's going to happen to those groups? It's a bit complicated chart, but until 1980s, Japan and the U.S., France, Germany, all countries have their own national vendors. But no longer right now. They are collaborating, merging, so it's complicated industry structure. If you look at the left-hand side, Areva, the French reactor vendor, is now merging with Germany, and they are supplying called EPR, European Pressurized Reactor. And this is all being under construction in Europe. And MHI used to team up with Westinghouse, but now Westinghouse is bought by Toshiba. So Toshiba and Westinghouse are working together to supply AP1000, PWR new reactor. Toshiba used to be working with GE and Hitachi supplying BWR. So now GE and Hitachi are working supplying BWR, called ESBWR, and also ABWR. And so Toshiba can supply both BWR and PWR. So it's a very good position in the global market. And using Westinghouse global market, Westinghouse supplying PWR all over the world, Toshiba is now in a very good position for global market. This is maybe too small to see, but in the United States, there are about 26 reactors under a license. And then if you can see, there are many AP1000 Westinghouse reactor type. Now it's purchased by Toshiba, so it's Japanese-American reactor, and also ESBWR, which used to be GE, Now GE and Hitachi are supplying. So it's an interesting competition right now in the United States. This Toshiba Westinghouse purchase 3 years ago, had changed nuclear industry structure very much strongly. As I said, there's no longer, you know, Hitachi GE versus Westinghouse Mitsubishi. Now it's so complicated, and there was a talk actually with the shrinking Japanese market, maybe Toshiba Hitachi and Toshiba Hitachi and Mitsubishi can join together to form one vendor group in Japan. It never happened. So Japanese nuclear industry now is split, fighting each other inside Japan. And these three nuclear groups are fighting in the global nuclear market. It's very competitive, very competitive. And METI used to have a project called Japanese Flag Light Water Reactor Project, which means, as I said, they want to export the Japanese reactor with the Japanese flag. But it's no longer possible because when you say Westinghouse, it's an American flag used to be, but it's now with the Japanese flag also. And Hitachi GE is also Japanese flag and Westinghouse and American flag. Areva is French flag and also German flag. So it's not that easy to define which country owns which reactor vendor. So this is no longer simple market to describe. If the French wants to export French reactor, it's no longer just French government. You have to talk with the German government. Same thing for Japan and United States. The strength and weakness of Japanese market is Japanese market was very was steady market, so they have a strong knowledge of the construction, manufacturing of a nuclear reactor. So that's a big advantage. And also, they have very good high quality, and seismic design is also very good. And particularly efficient construction management is very Japanese advantage. However, weakness, this is a key weakness, but Japan doesn't have natural uranium and also a fuel exporting capability. Right now, if you want to export reactor, you have to have a nuclear fuel cycle capability as a package. So that's the problem with Japanese reactor vendor. But now Japan can have a collaboration, a team with a U.S. market, U.S. vendor. Then you can have a strong team to include nuclear fuel cycle. And since Japan doesn't have an uranium, the government wants to secure uranium fuel and also enrichment capacity to team up with the Japanese vendor. This is Japanese more active nuclear diplomacy. And particularly interesting is resource diplomacy. This is 3 years ago, Prime Minister Koizumi, for the first time in Japan history, he went to Kazakhstan to make a deal to purchase uranium and with a big package, financial package, to help development in Kazakhstan. So this is a new trend that Japan is more active in resource diplomacy. And also, in order to help the U.S. reactor market, Japanese government is willing to provide loan guarantee for nuclear reactor export to the United States. This is also very new. And now they are also very active in negotiation with reaching the bilateral agreement with developing countries. And let's say, this is in Japanese, but if you see the national flag, Japan is now collaborating with different, very active in negotiating with the bilateral agreements, Vietnam, China, Kazakhstan, UAE, France, of course, and Indonesia. And this is unlike in the 10 years ago, Japanese was very cautious in negotiating with the bilateral agreements, but that's no longer the case. It's very active now. But the key country, India, Japan is still very cautious. And although they supported unanimously with the NSG nuclear supply group meeting with the U.S.-India cooperation, right now they have not committed to export reactors to India. And also, Japan is introducing a stronger export control and physical protection issues. Let me go very quickly. This is the complicated nature of the Japanese market. If Japanese vendors want to export to India, they cannot do it right now. But they have a team with USA. So if USA bilateral agreements with India, if they sell reactor, Toshiba possibly can export. But it's not clear because there's a component still in Japan. So you cannot export component without bilateral agreements. Meanwhile, Russia and France already have an agreement with India. So in the competitive, under the competitive market, this is a very difficult situation. How long Japan can say no to cooperation with India? The vendors is willing to export to India. So this is such a situation right now in Japanese market. Okay, let's move on to the spent fuel waste management. This is key issues for both civilian nuclear power program and non-proliferation. Because spent fuel, in a spent fuel, 1% of spent fuel is plutonium. And if you want to recycle plutonium, you have separate plutonium. Then it's the nuclear plutonium can be used for weapons purposes. So spent fuel management is key for both civilian nuclear power and the proliferation issues. And the problem is that the spent fuel is piling up in the reactor site. And the pool capacity, if the pool capacity is full, this, you cannot operate nuclear power plants anymore. You have shut down. So you have to move out the spent fuel somewhere else. And for Japanese case, the best place is for reprocessing plant to recycle plutonium. And that's why plutonium is piling up in Japan. And so how to reconcile the spent fuel management and also proliferation risk is a big issue. And also for civilian purposes, reprocessing is very expensive. So back end of fuel cycle, the financial political risk is very high. So the best solution, to my mind, my idea is to securing the spent fuel storage. If you have a capacity to store spent fuel storage, you don't need to reprocess. So that's the best way to avoid unnecessary reprocessing. But that's easy to say, but in the reality, it's very difficult. If you reprocess, you have recovered plutonium. And this is the plutonium stockpile from civilian sources and as well as military stockpile. Globally, roughly 500 tons of plutonium are now in stock. Half of it is a civilian. If you can see, France, Japan, Russia, and UK are piling up the plutonium because those are the four countries continue to reprocess. And the stockpile is increasing, and France, Japan, Russia, UK, those four countries continue to reprocess, and they have a, France and Japan are planning to use those plutonium, but it's not catching up, so the stockpile is increasing. So that's a huge concern for proliferation. And Japan continue to reprocess. If Japan continue to reprocess, it's going to pile up up to more, probably 40 tons in 2010, and eventually going down. The Germany stopped reprocessing, so if you use plutonium, stockpile is going down. So there's a need for Japan to control this stockpile management, which means also spent fuel management. And one of the approach was so-called multilateral nuclear fuel cycle approach, which is proposed by El Baradei. And I've been studying the condition for successful multilateral approach. I propose three conditions. One is universality, because the past proposal mostly proposed by countries who have a nuclear fuel cycle facilities. So that's why the countries who do not have a facility oppose it. They never work out. And also it's important to have a transparency, and also the economic viability is very important. And I don't have much time to go into detail, but we formed a group this year to propose a specific recommendation for nuclear fuel cycle arrangement from Japan. We propose five packages. The first one, we have to reduce this sensitive nuclear materials, particularly plutonium. So don't reprocess before you use an existing stockpile. And if you want to use plutonium, you have to specify the demand. Otherwise, you cannot reprocess. That's the first principle. The second one, all nuclear fuel cycle facilities should be internationalized without any exception. And the country who want to have a nuclear fuel cycle facility, you should seek for an international partner to make sure that transparency will be increased, and also number of facilities will be decreased in the future. And also the suppliers and recipient countries should develop a joint stockpile for nuclear fuel assurance. The third is a voluntary code of conduct for nuclear industry, for non-proliferation, and also we propose that the government and industry should develop a non-proliferation disarmament fund. The fourth proposal is a good time for Japan to re-examine nuclear fuel cycle policy. Right now, the Rokkasho reprocessing plant is stopped. It's a good time to think about what the future of the nuclear fuel cycle. And advanced nuclear power program, which does not involve a sensitive nuclear material, should be developed further. Japan has a very good technology base for that. And finally, for nuclear security, Japan should apply the best practices and to promote such best practices in the world with through international cooperation. Okay, that's the end of my presentation. Thank you very much.
Well, good morning, everyone, and thank you, Charlie, for such a great introduction. He said my vast publication record, it's kind of publish or perish, and but it's kept me off the street. This has been a very exciting time for nuclear energy and nuclear issues in general, especially non-proliferation policy, and I'll hope to segue into the non-proliferation panel at the end of my remarks today. Well, I was in Tokyo last week with Dr. Suzuki and Professor Akiyama and other dear colleagues. And when I got the invitation to speak here, and I saw also David Albright was going to be speaking on the next panel, and I was reminded of that famous line from the movie Casablanca, first round up the usual suspects. So here we are. So hopefully we'll provide some insights to you today. You'll also get a feeling of deja vu when you see some of my slides. You'll see Dr. Suzuki and I did not coordinate in advance. In fact, I was working on this yesterday evening. I told my class at Georgetown I had to hurry home because I'm still working on my talk. So I have some of the same slides, so I'll kind of breeze through some of those and just dwell on some other things that he said or some other things that weren't said. Well, here's the agenda. So I'll cover a brief overview of historic and current use of nuclear energy worldwide. Then we'll get into projections for future use and ask, will there actually be a renaissance? I think Dr. Suzuki has raised some question marks there as well. We'll look at the increasing globalization of the nuclear industry, as he mentioned as well. We'll look at then getting into the subject matter of today's workshop, how effective have GE Hitachi and Toshiba Westinghouse, those collaborations been in gaining market share and potential future market share, especially looking at India's opening market and other markets, especially if we have a couple dozen new countries who express interest in getting nuclear power plants. And then that's will segue into my closing remarks, looking at not just nuclear energy, but kind of the bigger picture, security and energy use worldwide. We've seen this slide before, so moving right along. You've seen a lot of this already as well. He said about 16%. It depends on kind of what year and figures you use, 15-16%, pretty much in the same ballpark. But we both agree, we're both citing the same source, 370 gigawatts of electrical power as of the end of last year. And here I have a bullet point showing you basically what a gigawatt of electrical power can provide, and certainly in a developed country. So think of a city, you know, or like Washington, D.C., sort of metropolitan area. So D.C. proper has roughly 500,000 people. You look at surrounding suburbs, roughly 1 million people. So you need basically kind of a large nuclear power plant to provide the amount of electricity you need for this area, to give you a reference point. 11 countries are involved in the enrichment business of uranium, and 5 countries are involved in reprocessing spent fuel to extract plutonium for either use in mixed oxide or MOX fuel or proposed use of MOX, as in Japan. And it's very important to point out no countries right now have a permanent geologic repository for spent fuel. But, you know, some countries are getting close. You know, Sweden, Finland in particular this year said they're getting close, moving along. France has a very active program. I was in France in April. They're getting close to perhaps making a decision sometime soon. But the first repository probably not going to open at least until 2020. And I won't even get into Yucca Mountain. We could spend all day talking about that. Here's a slide you haven't seen before. It shows you all the 30-some countries using nuclear energy to generate electricity in the world. And here are figures as of the end of 2007 showing net electrical energy that had been generated. And you see the United States is in the lead. Often people think France is in the lead because France is generating 77-78% of its electricity from nuclear power. No, indeed, USA is still number one in this area with our 104 nuclear reactors, but 19% of our electricity comes from nuclear. France is second, Japan's in third place, and then you can see going on down the line. Well, Dr. Suzuki mentioned a number of reactors currently under construction. I'll get into that later on in my talk, but I think it's important to briefly look at how this has fluctuated over the last decade or two. And you see anywhere from a high of 53, we're back up to around 53 now, depending on how you count, down to a low of 26. It's important to realize a lot of these reactors under construction have been on the books for a couple of decades, some cases more than three decades. In the case of Watts Bar 2, that project began in the early 1970s here in the United States and has yet to be completed. Well, just looking at very recent developments in the past year or two, as of summer this year, International Atomic Energy Agency listed 436 operating nuclear reactors in the world, and that's eight less than in 2002, which was the peak year. But as Dr. Suzuki pointed out, and you saw another slide, the previous year was actually a peak year of power generation because of the capacity upratings, the capacity factor has gone up, and there have been a lot of safety improvements and kept the downtime of plants low. And so its nuclear powers have been able to still maintain the level it has been over roughly the last decade. It's important to note that last year, for the first time in commercial nuclear power plant history, no new unit actually went online. That may change dramatically in coming years, especially with a lot of the construction going on in China. Also in 2008, three reactors were actually shut down. And the total installed capacity that last year actually went down about 1,600 megawatts of electrical power. And that's equivalent to one EPR, European pressurized water reactor, that Areva is building in Finland and France. Here taking something that I worked on with my research associate, Michelle Smith, and that we published in Foreign Policy magazine earlier this year. These numbers are a moving target, so don't focus too much on some of the specific figures, especially China and India, because those figures are changing almost as we speak. But this gives you an interesting snapshot of the expressed interest in a number of countries that don't have nuclear power plants. You see they're kind of colored in that sort of tan brown shade. And then you'll see the about 30-some countries that have nuclear power. The triangles represent the number of reactors that are under construction, and that's changed somewhat since we've done this graph, but it's roughly where it was about a year ago. And you also see in the numerals the number of reactors that are proposed in various countries. And you see in the U.S., we have up to 32 reactors that could potentially be built if all the licenses are approved, if all the funding goes through, everything goes through smoothly, we might have that number under construction in the coming, say, 10, 20 years or so. Well, there are a lot of barriers to nuclear construction, as many of you know. Three of the big barriers are financing or cost, the long construction time, or actually long project time. Just don't look at the construction time, but the whole project completion time. And the number of personnel, highly qualified people that are required to build these high technology projects. And so you can see the range of estimates of the cost figures, the so-called overnight cost, and the project completion time. That project completion time may be much shorter in China, for instance. with sort of the labor cost and their ability to streamline things because, you know, one-party rule, they've been able to shrink that construction time much faster than we've seen in U.S. or some European countries. Well, nuclear power's usage also depends pretty significantly on governments and government policy, government incentives, the ability to streamline regulations or not, the ability to offer loan guarantees through federal programs or other types of programs, offering credits on companies' taxes. And there are all sorts of other additional incentives that could be offered. And I'm not saying this is right or wrong, I'm just saying this is a fact of life. It's a fact of life for any energy source industry, so we need to be honest about it. It's also probably true that if we can get some type of fee on carbon emissions, greenhouse gas emissions in the United States and increasing other countries, nuclear power is going to look a lot more competitive compared to fossil fuel sources. However, that depends strongly on fossil fuel availability and pricing, especially when we look at natural gas availability and prices. Natural gas prices are pretty low right now. Yeah, I know we're in the doldrums in terms of the economy, and that has a significant effect, but we've seen a lot of new natural gas reserves being discovered, and that is going to have a major effect on the ability to finance and get new nuclear projects off the ground. What we see is that when you look at capital construction costs, they tend to be high for nuclear, very low for natural gas, and somewhere in the middle for coal. And it's an inverse relationship when it comes to fuel costs. Nuclear fuel costs tend to be low. Natural gas costs historically have been kind of high, but they fluctuated a lot. Now they're kind of low. And coal prices are somewhere in the middle. And so, you know, this really comes down to financing. It reminds me of a presidential campaign slogan. It's economy, we say, it's economy smarty. Well, even if we get a lot of new reactors being built in major developing countries such as China, Brazil, and India, that's good. But we need to realize that for the next couple of decades, those countries will still generate a small fraction of electricity from nuclear power. And they're going to rely, especially in China and India, increasing on coal. Brazil has a lot of hydro they can draw from. But we need to just face the fact of life that China and India in particular are going to be using a lot of fossil fuels. Well, to try to put some numbers on or the rate of construction needed to try to just keep pace with 15 or 16% of global electricity generated by nuclear, if we just want to keep running on that treadmill at an even pace, how fast do we have to bring online nuclear power plants? Well, you can do the calculation. And if you have a benchmark of about 1,000 megawatt electrical power rating plant, I know some of the newer plants coming online are higher ratings, so some are up to 1,600 megawatts electrical. But just as a kind of ballpark figure, if you bring online a 1,000 megawatt electric plant, you need to bring that online roughly every 16 days for the next 21 years in order to keep pace with the global share of electrical energy from nuclear. Now let's look at climate change, because many people are saying nuclear can play an increasing role in countering climate change. And nuclear has played a significant role so far in reducing greenhouse gas emissions. That's a fact. Can it do more? It can, but in order to do more, to take even a 1/7 slice, and I pick 1/7 because I'm calling on the Pakala-Sokolow wedge model from 2004, two Princeton researchers published a seminal article in Science magazine showing 15 technologies that we could deploy, and if you picked 7 of them and one of those 7 would reduce 1 billion tons of greenhouse gas emissions per year by 2050, mid-century, if you just look at the nuclear slice, you'd have to bring online one of these 1,000 megawatt electrical plants roughly every 14 days or every 2 weeks between now and mid-century. Well, is that impossible? No. It's been done before. If you go back to the heyday of the 1980s, especially when you look at construction going on in Japan and France and even in the United States and some other countries, we were basically building pretty much at that rate. But what I'm saying is you have to then replicate that rate of construction for the next four decades or so. That's going to be very daunting, and it's going to require a lot of, you know, serious thought about industry competitiveness and collaboration and competition with other sources of energy. Looking at energy capacity projections, here I'm using EIA figures, Energy Information Agency figures, and you look at from, I'm using 2006 as a kind of a benchmark, projecting out to 2030, this is kind of business as usual type projections, you'll see that nuclear, they're projecting it's going to go up somewhat, but it's important to note, nuclear compared to coal or especially liquids, i.e. mainly petroleum, is still a very small fraction of worldwide energy use. And here's another kind of look at in the bar chart and showing how nuclear compares to renewables. Renewables here includes hydro as well as wind and solar. So most of that renewables is actually hydropower, not wind and solar. Wind and solar are still pretty much niche technologies. Natural gas, increasing share, and coal, you can see, also keeps going up. The liquids, i.e. petroleum, pretty much stays relatively steady compared to the other ones. You've seen this chart before, and I titled this more of a pessimistic or maybe realistic type of projection based on Michael Schneider's take. Now, here it's important to point out the fine print is that this is based on the 40-year mean lifetime. Now, that's based on kind of historical practice and nominal licensing, but we've seen that begin to change, especially in the United States, because if you plot out, if you assume that we get 20-year life extensions for all the existing 104 reactors in the U.S., that's going to extend out for another 20 years of the 40-year lifetime. And we've seen, I know, roughly 30 or so, maybe up to 40 of the U.S. reactors either having received a license extension in the last few years or on the verge of getting one, and I'm going to project that most of these reactors are probably going to get life extensions. Let's be generous and say all of them get that. And so assuming that, and assuming that there's no new construction, what we'll see is that we reach a retirement cliff just a few years after 2030. If we don't get additional life extensions, say out to 80 years, and there's some talk about that, but that's still very speculative, we're going to be forced to start decommissioning a lot of these U.S. reactors. Now, you may say, you know, that's 20-some years from now. You know, that's almost a whole generation in terms of a human lifetime. Well, but those of you who follow the industry know that's almost tomorrow. We need to start planning for that today in order to be ready for this event. Otherwise, we're going to see a steep declining share of nuclear energy to use produce electricity in the United States. Okay, getting into the whole issue of the alliance between Japan and the U.S. and how competitive it is compared to other vendors. And as Dr. Suzuki mentioned, it's a very globalized industry now. It's very complicated and kind of chart you can, diagram you can use. Here I'm just showing some pictures just to indicate what's at stake. If you look at the market share by vendor, and here I'm using data from Areva, so I don't know, maybe I'm not taking a grain of salt, and I think it's a good data. But here you'll see, Dr. Suzuki was mentioning that Areva offers the whole suite of services, the front end, the enrichment and fuel services, reactors, other services to maintain the reactors, and then the back end, which involves spent fuel recycling or reprocessing, some would say. And then you see Areva, if you add up the market share they have in all those three areas, they surpass the other vendors. And then the FAAE is basically the Russians. The Russians are also vertically integrated. They offer all three areas of services. And then Westinghouse, Toshiba, that collaboration is, if you put them together, they're number three. But if actually you put GE Nuclear and Hitachi, if you stack them together, they would actually be number three in this list, and then Westinghouse, Toshiba, and then Mitsubishi Heavy Industries, then USEC, United States Enrichment Corporation, which basically just does uranium enrichment and a few other services, And then Urenco as another enrichment company, and Cameco also on the front end as well. And AECL is the Canadian-owned nuclear industry. All right, so now if we look at what's happening today in terms of reactors under construction and what designs are actually being built, what are these designs based on? Well, it depends on the number of reactors under construction actually depends on how you count it up. So if you look at the IAEA, their database says 53, but a number of those are sort of kind of oddball reactors, and because I know Dr. Suzuki mentioned 45 or 46, so there's 7 or 8 in there. You can say, they've been on the books for a while. There are maybe some smaller reactors in Russia. And so if you just look at kind of the larger commercial reactors, so the PWRs, BWRs, they're roughly 45 or 46. So that's why if you add up the numbers in my bar charts here, they don't quite add up to 53. What you'll find is that more than 2/3 of the reactors under construction are in 4 countries right now, China, India, Russia, South Korea. And you'll see that also that 2/3 of the reactors under construction are either of Russian design or Chinese/French-derived design, because China had a tech transfer agreement with France. So China's been making a lot of these replication reactors, some people call them the CPR 1000 series. So there are several of those right now. They're under construction. So then when you go away from the Russian and Chinese plants being built, and you look at the U.S.-Japanese collaboration or what U.S.-Japan have done individually, you'll see that they have about 12 reactors right now under construction, and the Indians have 3 of their kind of indigenous/Canadian-derived designs under construction, and the French have 2 of their EPRs under construction in Finland and in France. Well, if you exclude the reactors that have been on the books for more than 20 years, and you just look at the activity, say, over the last 10 years, you'll see that the Russian column goes pretty far down based on where it was before. The Chinese column is still pretty high because China has been recently entering into this new construction in the last really couple of years, especially with their designs based on the French tech transfer design. And then you'll see more than 1/4 of the other reactors under construction in the last 10 years are from the U.S.-Japanese commercial alliance or from U.S. and Japanese companies prior to alliances being formed. So then I was asked the question, does the U.S.-Japan alliance compare to what the French and the Russians are doing? And it appears my look at the data and also my research associates' look at the data that the French and Russian firms have a bit of an edge right now in signing up agreements or nearing agreements with countries in the emerging markets. And we've in particular seen that since 2006 that President Sarkozy and Areva CEO Anne Lauvergeon have been very active and trotting the globe, especially in the Middle East and North Africa, signing a lot of agreements. And I've also signed some agreements in Southeast Asia with Thailand and Vietnam. And they seem to have a bit of an edge with the United Arab Emirates. That deal is going through just a few days ago. It basically quietly passed Congress. There were really no major objections raised. So there are $40 billion projects at stake right now in the UAE. And it could be a winner-take-all situation. So we're talking about maybe 4 or 5, maybe even 6 reactors they want to bring online, say, in the next maybe 10, 15 years. And so, Areva appears to be somewhat in the lead right now, according to a lot of analysts. U.S.-Japan collaboration does have a horse in that race right now, and so does Korea. So really those are the 3 entities right now where they're trying to get that $40 billion market. The Russians have also been pretty active. They've signed up agreements in Belarus and Jordan, Nigeria, and Turkey. It's not clear whether they actually build reactors in those countries. But as we know, they have been building in India and also Iran. The U.S. hasn't been too far behind. Professor Suzuki already talked about Japan's agreement, so I won't mention that. I'll just say that U.S. has signed some new agreements with countries in the Middle East and also other parts of the world, Egypt, Indonesia, India, Morocco, and UAE are worth mentioning. Speaking of India, how does that stand right now? I know Dr. Suzuki mentioned that as well. Let me just focus on what's been happening recently since the deal has been signed. I know a lot of angst appeared here in Washington over the last few years about this deal, and it's gone through. And part of the deal is that India has agreed to put those new reactors under safeguards. But it's very important to mention that there still be no really real constraints on India's weapons program. They could still make plenty of plutonium for their bombs if they wanted to. But in terms of actual commercial contracts, Secretary Clinton went to New Delhi in July, and she basically got an agreement or diplomatic agreement from Indian government that certain sites would be open to the U.S.-Japan collaboration. And in fact, just 2 weeks ago, you read in Nucleonics Week, that GE Hitachi with their ABWR technology is slated for a site in Gujarat State, and Westinghouse Toshiba with the AP1000 is slated for a site in Andhra Pradesh. And I don't know exactly how many reactors may be built at those sites, but it appears that the U.S.-Japan collaboration will get some slice of that emerging market. Dr. Suzuki mentioned some hurdles on the Japan side for this deal. Let me mention two that are relevant for the U.S. side. India has still yet to finalize a liability agreement that's needed for U.S. vendors. And I know there's a lot of different liability agreements that are out there in the world. The U.S. prefers the Convention on Submarine Compensation, CSC, and still trying to get India to complete that. It's my understanding. I'm not a lawyer, but if there's a lawyer in the audience, I see some actually. They can correct me if I'm wrong. But that's a major stumbling block. And the other one is that India would like to reprocess U.S. origin spent fuel, and we still have yet to resolve that issue. Now, quickly turning to larger global issues and segueing into the nonproliferation topic, I think we need to understand that nuclear energy is embedded and very much in a global energy system and also with global security concerns. And I mentioned Iran previously, so that's an outstanding example of that. And the concerns that if Iran goes ahead with a nuclear weapons program, we might see a so-called cascade of proliferation in the Middle East. Well, 31 years ago, a law was passed in the United States called the Nuclear Nonproliferation Act, and in Title V, it said that the United States should carry out an assessment of alternative energies to fossil fuels and nuclear energy, considering nonproliferation and economic factors. We have yet to follow through with that law. Now, this is something that really needs to be done, especially as the developing world is desperate for new energy sources, and we got to be realistic. Most of the developing world not going to be ready for nuclear power plants, and they're going to need other means of support. They might have to turn to some more efficient use of fossil fuels as well, and as well as renewables. So we need to really look at this a very comprehensive way. And I think Dr. Suzuki did a great job talking about the fuel cycle issues. I'll just amplify one of his points. We need to pursue a non-discriminatory approach when we talk about these, not just talk about, but when we actually truly implement and design these proposals for the developing world. We saw a major pushback in July at the IAEA from a lot of developing nations saying they felt that their rights were not being respected. Well, speaking of the developing world, there's an urgent need to really do a comprehensive, integrated assessment of these countries' energy needs and weighing all the costs, all the benefits, including security costs, safety, every cost, environmental cost as well, and looking from at the energy security standpoint. And that could be a whole workshop in itself. So I got to be very brief because my time's running out. I will mention, though, in terms of the nuclear area, there is some interesting work being done, especially by Toshiba. They've been investigating what are called micro nuclear reactors and also the 4S reactor, which are down to a level of about 10 megawatts of electrical power. And it can also be upwards of the small and medium power reactors, a couple hundred megawatts up to 400, 600 megawatts electrical power. And depending on how these reactors are designed, they could offer some proliferation-resistant benefits. You can have, in fact, a nuclear battery you can deliver to a country, and you can basically plug it into the grid, pretty much leave it alone, is my understanding. It's, of course, yet to be fully carried out. And then you would have power for anywhere from 10 to 30 years, depending on how this thing is fueled. And then you could then, once it's done, unplug it, take it back to the supplier country, and so the client country would not have to deal with any of the nuclear waste issue as well. That would all be worked into the package. So there's a lot of hurdles to cross for those technologies to see the commercial market. One of the big ones is the regulatory hurdle, and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission was asked a couple years ago by Toshiba to begin to review these types of reactors, and the commissioner said, we'd be happy to, but it's going to take a while because, one, we got a big backlog of license requests here in the U.S. for the standard reactors. We got to get through those. And this is a brand-new technology, and we got to be very careful. We make sure we got to get it right. And then there's the whole issue of, will these things actually be cost-effective? We don't know, but it's worth researching and developing them just to find out. Well, I'll close with a view of the Earth at night, showing what's lit up and what's not lit up. And you'll see that certainly in the eastern part of the United States and the West Coast and most of Europe and very much in Japan and South Korea and increasingly in India and a good part of China, a lot of lights are on. And lots of other parts of the world, or there's a lot of deserts out there too and mountains, a lot of people aren't going to live there. But there are a lot of parts of the world, you look at North Korea, it's very dark. It's a patch of darkness there, pretty much. And then lots of Africa and good parts of South America. So if you want a good visual of emerging markets and where we could be providing more electricity, because it's been estimated that around 1 billion people don't even have access to electricity, and more than 1.5 billion people don't have reliable access to electricity. So you put those together, so you have about a third, a little bit more than a third of humanity either does not have access to electricity or has no reliable or very little reliable access to electricity. Thank you for your attention.
I want to thank both Dr. Suzuki and Dr. Ferguson for two very provocative presentations. Knowing some of you in the audience, I would be very surprised if there aren't some good questions. I would just like to start to get us going with take the prerogative of the chair and ask the following. What are your gentlemen's respective views on the effectiveness of the IAEA and the Nuclear Suppliers Group in terms of really obviating further weapons proliferation? And I'm thinking particularly, you know, when we look at the fact that we know there's been leakage to North Korea from some companies in Japan and perhaps elsewhere, despite all the safeguards agreements, we know that South Africa, at least initially when they were building a bomb, were able to get past past all the agreements. We know the AQCON network, of course. And I ask it in the context of what do you think we need to do to strengthen the IAEA as we look towards the NPT review conference, and why have these mistakes been allowed to occur in the past?
Well, not because Mr. Amano was elected as the new director of IAEA. I've always been a fan of IAEA. IAEA actually inspection technology and personal professional staff, their expertise are very excellent, and they have been improving technology quite well, and their monitoring capability has been increasing. Additional protocol was excellent tool to look for so-called undeclared facilities. So I believe if IAEA is in safeguards in place in country, it's very difficult to develop a weapons program. The problem is that some countries who do not accept IAEA safeguards. So so our efforts should universalize the conditions to accept IAEA safeguards and additional protocol as much as possible, as soon as possible. But still, the export control is a different thing, which is very difficult. And nuclear suppliers group was not good enough, as you mentioned. I think we have to come up with probably more enforcing export control rules in the global community. And particularly in Japanese case, I've been studying the so-called third-party export. There are some small, specialized, small, medium companies selling sensitive material, sensitive equipment to Thailand or other countries who have much less stringent export control and then export to North Korea. So that's a concern, and we need to have, again, more global, uniformal export control rules with some kind of enforcing mechanism.
Well, Charlie, I was reminded of Hans Blix's thoughts on what the IAEA needed. When Dr. Blix was IAEA Director General, he said he needed three things. And Larry Scheinman reminded me of this yesterday when he talked to my class at Georgetown University. Number one, the IAEA needed greater access to people. People in the know, people working on nuclear programs in various countries. Number two, they needed better access to locations, not just declared facilities, but also to investigate the existence of undeclared facilities. And number three, they needed better access to the United Nations Security Council. And that's the body, the authority figure, so to speak, that has to weigh in on what needs to be done in cases of violation of safeguards agreements. And we've been seeing kind of a failure of that, or at least a weak application of that body to safeguards violations in Iran and also, I would say, in North Korea. And it could continue if we don't really strengthen those three areas. And then in addition, I would say we need to make the additional protocol to safeguards agreements or the equivalent of the additional protocol in certain countries' cases, the standard for supplying nuclear materials and technologies. Now, we saw a tip of the hat to additional protocol in President Obama's UN Security Council Resolution 1887 in late September. It was kind of hortatory language. It said basically countries should consider and encourage the additional protocol when deciding whether to supply technologies to other states. We can do better than that.
Yes.
And, right. And I know there are only a few countries out there who have been raising some objections, and that's why I said additional protocol or its equivalent in certain cases I think is worth considering. And one final point is about the Article 10 withdrawal clause of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. We've seen one country exercise that. It's North Korea. They left in January 2003. I say at least the North Koreans respected the treaty enough to use the withdrawal clause. They didn't just leave sort of willy-nilly. Some may think that. But they did go through the sort of 90-day period. They did it in a funny way, of course. They started the clock back in 94, and they got to the 89th day, and they stopped, and we had the agreed framework, and that lasted for a while. That went bust, and in 2002, and then January 2003, another day clicked over, and they said, okay, we're out. But at least they kind of went through the motions. So I think we can do better than going through motions. I think what we need to do is to use the UN Security Council to say,
in cases of where countries are in violation of their safeguards agreement and they decide to exercise their sovereign rights to leave the treaty, they have certain requirements. They need to at least undergo a special inspection, which is in the charter of the IAEA. You go back to, you know, when the agency was founded in 1957. Special inspections are in there. It shouldn't be such an unusual thing to do. So we could build on that precedent to get the UN Security Council to say, look, countries need to show us that they haven't misused technologies they gain while, quote, unquote, a good member of the NPT. And I know a lot of people are thinking, good luck, Charles, getting that passed and enforced. But at least the first step is to have a serious discussion about this and try to get this debated. Thanks.
Okay, the floor is open to all of you. Would you please identify yourself, and if you're directing the question to one particular panelist, please say who that is. Sharon?
Sharon Squassoni from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Thanks for two great presentations. I wanted to follow up on the question of the additional protocol. For Charles, you said the additional protocol or the equivalent. This is a phrase that the Argentines and Brazilians favor because they don't want to sign the additional protocol. So I'd like you to, if you could, spin out what that equivalent might mean. I'm a little skeptical. And for Dr. Suzuki, I was told by Ministry of Foreign Affairs officials in Japan in April that Japan actually has adopted the additional protocol as a condition for supply, which is a terrific development. I have never seen anyone anywhere tout this as, you know, a step in the right direction. So my question really relates to markets. Do you think that this in any way affects Japan's ability to export to other countries in any way as a hindrance? Because one of the things I'd like to see is that industries, if countries can't adopt this, that maybe industries, you know, firms could adopt additional protocol as a condition for supply without any adverse market effects. Thanks.
Well, your question about Brazil is very apt, Sharon. I was actually supposed to be in Rio today, and it went bust. And, well, I'm kind of glad it went bust, because I'm glad I'm here today. This is a really great workshop, and you know, there's all sorts of visa issues and everything trying to get to Brazil. That's a whole other political issue. But what's going on in Rio is a non-proliferation and nuclear energy conference. And I wanted to talk to some Brazilian colleagues about this very issue that you raise. And my understanding is that there are two concerns that Brazilians have. One is that proprietary information about their enrichment plant might be revealed through, say, additional protocol. And two is that they have worries about their naval program. They, for many years, have the dream of fueling submarines with nuclear fuel. And it's my understanding that when that second issue, additional protocol wouldn't really, you know, have any kind of effect if they want to have a naval nuclear program. They can do that. It wouldn't stop them from doing it. That's allowed. But the first issue about the proprietary concerns, I think we could probably craft something. And I know there's people much more expert on this than I am. In fact, my former boss is working with the Brazilians on this. So I don't know. I don't really have a detailed plan that I could tell you and others about how to implement sort of its equivalent in Argentina and Brazil. But I think it would have to involve, you know, clear IEA oversight. We'd have to have a system where there's enough confidence where those neighboring countries and the world would have confidence there aren't any kind of hidden facilities in Brazil or Argentina that can be used in a nuclear weapons program. So basically what I'm saying is we need to adhere to the philosophical concept embedded in additional protocol that the inspection system should go beyond just mere accounting or bank auditing to being like a Sherlock Holmes and to being a true investigator and to figure out whether there's anything hidden in countries that we're studying. So I think if we can do that, then we can develop, you know, confidence that there's the equivalent of an additional protocol in place.
Well, thank you for the question. Thank you for letting me know the decision about Minister of Foreign Affairs. I wasn't aware that if they did it, they did it very, very quietly. And but I know that they have been pushing very hard about additional protocol as a condition. And I've been talking with the nuclear industry people regarding this the impact. My answer is probably not that much, because if you look at the global nuclear market, the majority, the largest majority, is in Western Europe and the United States. So for those areas, no effect. But some of the countries, like India, for instance, it's very sensitive. And so some particular business, yes, they may have some worry. But in a global sense, additional protocol as a condition for export is a very good thing to do. Actually, nuclear industry believe it's better for them to have a safe export business. So I think they are happy with that condition, basically in general.
Hi, my name's Seth, and I'm just a citizen. I'm not associated with anyone. But my question is actually about the nuclear battery thing. I've actually read that as well. But I don't understand it from a proliferation perspective. I mean, if this is a nuclear reactor that can fit on a railroad car, let's say, and has no containment building, I mean, I don't understand why someone couldn't just dig it out of the ground and drive it around and, I mean, just let the reactor run and it'd be as bad as a nuclear bomb. I mean, maybe not quite as much, but, you know, it'd be just sending radiation all over the city or something. Can you help me understand how that could possibly work from a proliferation perspective?
Yeah, good question. I'm an expert on these nuclear batteries. I'm saying that there are some who are saying if you do it right, you might be able to make it proliferation resistant. But I was trying to say that we don't know yet. And this really, we need to do a very vigorous investigation of all these different designs that are being considered. I think the one question mark is would it be fueled with highly enriched uranium, and you don't want to do that. So, and you want to be able to have high burn-up type of fuel. So the isotopic composition of the stuff that's in the spent fuel is very undesirable for nuclear weapons. You want to make it so that if someone actually tried to break in to the reactor, they would get irradiated with a lethal dose of ionizing radiation. So that has a protective barrier against, you know, theft. Now, sure, you know, if a country has some sophisticated techniques and they have the proper shielding, I mean, it's possible they could, you know, extract it and maybe grab some material out of it, maybe some radioactive stuff for radiological dirty bomb. But my understanding, and I haven't looked at these in depth, is you could probably design these things so that what's coming out of the reactor at the end is not very desirable for an actual nuclear weapon.
My name is Takuori from Hitachi. I'd like to ask Mr. Ferguson, thank you very much for your informative presentation. Reactor manufacturers are doing and promoting from the standpoint of the energy supply and energy security. But we, our activities face the non-proliferation issues always. But this non-proliferation is the issue that the government should take leadership. So what is the, do you think, the best way or practical way to coordinate the harmony between government policy on non-proliferation and private sector's business strategies?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. And I think industry can play a much greater role, but ultimately it's a governmental responsibility. And one big question is, who's going to pay for additional resources for the safeguard system? Because Charlie started off with a question about the IAEA and Nuclear Surprise Group and what needs to be done. And another thing that I should have mentioned is resources. The IAEA has been starved for resources. They've been on a sort of a zero real growth financial regime for many years. And that was lifted last year. They got a bump up, I think, about 8% or so. And they had another bump up, I guess, back in, was it 2003 or 2004. But it's not adequate. What we've seen is a growth in nuclear materials that need to be safeguarded by roughly a factor of 3 over the last 20 years. And there hasn't been a corresponding growth in the ability of the International Atomic Energy Agency to at least even monitor all that growing amount of material. So what's the role of industry? My view, I think, similar to Thomas Shea, who from Pacific Northwest National Lab, a lot of you know of him, and a couple of years ago, maybe it's 3 or 4 years ago, he wrote a paper for actually Henry Sokolsky and saying that we should assess the amount of money for safeguards based on each country's proportional use of nuclear energy, and in order to make sure that each country is doing its fair share and that each country actually is then factoring in that external cost of safeguards into the internal cost of nuclear energy.
Jim Goodby, Brookings Institution. I wonder if you could comment on the International Fuel Center that the Russians have set up at Angarsk and speculate, if you would, about whether there's any possibility that the Chinese might consider an equivalent facility where they have been working with the Russians on a uranium enrichment plant in China.
Thank you. The Russian Enrichment Center is an interesting idea to promote both nuclear fuel assurance and non-proliferation. The problem is that the nuclear fuel bank proposal, which is they hope that more countries will join the business, is not so popular. Unfortunately, the recipient countries are not happy with the conditions. I mean, the Russia is still controlling the nuclear fuel bank, although it says IAEA can manage the fuel bank. And also, the majority of the center will still be controlled by the Russian government. So although they claim this is a pure business venture, it's not clearly the case. So as a business, I think it's an interesting idea. But in terms of non-proliferation and the fuel assurance scheme, they still have questions to address. So even for Chinese, if China developed a similar center, probably the same question will remain. So my idea of internationalization of nuclear fuel cycle facilities is more on a more private base, kind of joint ownership by the companies, and then backup by the governmental agreement to monitor those activities, like a Urenco case. That's probably better accepted by the nuclear industry.
Alan Madian, LECG. I've been working with Ontario Power Generation in terms of their procurement, and as you probably know, having gone through a couple of years of study with looking at 8 separate nuclear providers, the decision was made that the cost was too high. That's observation number one. Observation number two is that the reported costs of nuclear power plants in China being built by the Chinese using designs that were originally coming from the West is between 25% and 30% of the cost that is being quoted by U.S. manufacturers for overnight costs. So there are two things that seem to me to be worth asking about. One is, how realistic are the forecasts of in terms of increasing nuclear power plants, given these very high costs coming from the West, and secondly, looking out between, let's say, 10 and 30 years, should we be expecting that a majority of new nuclear power plants may be being built by the Chinese, and what are the implications of that for nuclear proliferation?
Yeah, great questions. I was in China in April. There were two expositions going. There was an expo going on, and there was an international conference sponsored by the IAEA, Interministerial Conference. And just a mile away, there was a vendors expo. And I went to both, and it was just incredible what was going on at the vendors expo. It was more exciting than Interministerial Conference. Interministerial Conference, all these energy ministers and nuclear energy officials got up and just made a lot of speeches. You actually go to the expo and you talk to the vendors, especially the Chinese who are working in this area, and they're very open. They'll talk a lot about this. But it's really hard to get them to talk about cost. And I'm skeptical about these cost estimates they have. I think there's probably a lot of things are hidden. And state-owned enterprises, and the Chinese government may not be quoting us the real figure here. But as we know, they're sitting on huge foreign cash reserves. And they made the executive decision to go forward with a major expansion of nuclear construction. And I think from their standpoint, it makes a lot of sense, especially when you look at their coal industry. They had some serious problems last winter in making sure they got coal supplies delivered to the coal plants, and there's a fairly large distance between a lot of the coal mines and the major cities that need the coal power, and a lot of the rail lines couldn't deliver an adequate supplies of coal in time. So that was one of the major tipping points that convinced the government in Beijing that they needed to go ahead more aggressively with nuclear power. So in some sense, it's kind of an internal energy security concern because they still have a good amount of coal. And they're also trying to develop more efficient coal plants as well, which we should encourage them to do that because then maybe eventually they can do carbon capture and storage with it in the future. And your second question, I was going to have actually a slide titled The China Syndrome and the Alternative China Syndrome. Yeah, I guess 30 years ago was the release of the movie The China Syndrome, and that would refer to the hypothetical situation that there were a nuclear plant meltdown, say in the U.S., and it could go, the material could go all the way through the earth and pop out into China right now. But that's what it referred to. But now we're seeing a different type of China Syndrome, and China, I think, is going about this, from their perspective, very smart way, signing these technology transfer agreements. I mentioned all these replication reactors they're building, most of them based on kind of French designs, which really the French designs originated basically in the U.S. And then they also have an agreement with Westinghouse Toshiba for an AP1000, the first inland nuclear power plant is going to be of that model. And they're trying to arrange a similar tech transfer agreement to get U.S. and Japanese technology transferred there. So I think you're right. I mean, 10, or at least maybe, at least within 30 years, they're going to be up there as a major supplier.
Thank you. Song Ho-shin at Synapse, visiting fellow at the moment. And my question is about this coming negotiation between South Korea and United States about atomic energy agreement. And given your expertise on Japan's past experience, obviously South Korea is now trying to follow the Japan's footsteps, which happened in the late 80s. And South Korea, given its very heavy dependence on the nuclear energy, they want to have some more full cycle capability in nuclear energy. So given Japan's experience in the late 80s, Professor Suzuki, what would you think the most difficult challenge for South Korea in following the Japanese model? And for Dr. Ferguson, what could be the Obama administration's response to this coming very difficult issue? Thank you.
That's very difficult question to answer. Of course, I'm not the government official, so I'm talking about my personal opinion. The most difficult challenge is recycling, reprocessing issue. And my personal suggestion is that, as I propose in my presentation, not just South Korea, not just Japan, in the future, all nuclear fuel cycle facilities may have to be internationalized eventually. So instead of seeking its own national right to reprocess, it'd be better for South Korea and even probably for Japan too to search for some kind of arrangement for international, under international arrangement to reprocess spent fuel. Otherwise, it's very difficult to get the approval from the United States. So that my suggestion is that is there any way that South Korea can look for international program so which can allow South Korea to conclude the fuel cycle? And one suggestion is Japan actually has its own reprocessing plant, but its technology comes from France, and also advanced fuel cycle technology comes from the United States. And for advanced fuel cycle technology, we do not have our own reprocessing facility. We reprocess spent fuel in Europe. So that's one possible model that South Korea can follow.
Yeah, very complicated issue, as Dr. Suzuki is saying. From the U.S. perspective, it's a balancing act, walking a tight wire. The U.S. doesn't want to get into the political problem of the North-South Korean agreement not to do enrichment and reprocessing on the Korean Peninsula. So we have to deal with that issue. And I know a lot of Korean experts and politicians have been saying, well, the North Korean issue, that's political. Here is this something different. This is something to do on commercial energy. And I understand that, but still there, that linkage is still there. So that's a big sticking point. Two is that South Korea, when they established a low-level waste facility, the government paid too much money. So that established a bad precedent, to be honest. So then there were worries that in order to site a high-level waste facility, it's going to cost an astronomical sum of money. And South Korea is a small country, about the size of Virginia. So there's not a whole lot of available pieces of land for a high-level waste or spent fuel repository. So, and we know that by 2016, that spent fuel pools in South Korea are going to be at capacity. So what do we do? As Dr. Suzuki said, one option could be South Korea could send its spent fuel to France, but that's going to cost a lot of money. Japan is paying a lot of money. You ask what the per gram price is for storage of plutonium in France. It's huge. So that's not necessarily going to save money. It's also going to kind of kick the can down the road. Well, one suggestion I've been kind of batting around, I don't know if this is good or not, but I'll throw it out there, is that the U.S. could open the door a crack for South Korea to continue doing some research on, say, pyroprocessing with the U.S. collaboration. And that may be enough for the time being for then South Korean government to tell their people, at least we got the U.S. working with us here to a possible long-term solution. And this is truly long-term, because to close that loop, you would need fast reactors, and there's big question marks whether they're going to work and be cost-effective. But if you do that, maybe you can then begin the process of also establishing a high-level waste facility, because you're going to need that no matter what, because you're going to get fission products coming out no matter whether you do pyroprocessing fast reactors, or you just do the traditional storage methods, or even the once through recycling that happens in France. So you're still going to need a high-level waste facility. So if you can have an agreement saying the U.S. still is going to work with South Korea to find a long-term solution, that may provide a pathway for.
I'm sorry we have run out of time, that we didn't get to all your questions. Hopefully you may be able to ask them of the next panel. But I want to thank Dr. Ferguson and Dr. Suzuki for an excellent presentations. Thank you. Well, I'll take a 10-minute break, and then we'll have the next panel.
Okay, let me start. Ladies and gentlemen, my name is Shoei Chito. I'm a visiting fellow at the Center for Northeast Asian Policy Studies here at the Brookings Institution. I'm delighted to moderate one of today's exciting panels. I'm sure you have already enjoyed the first excellent panel. We are going to have another excitement from now. Now we turn to the question of disarmament and non-proliferation, which again, the United States and Japan share tremendous interest in common. President Obama, in his famous speech in Prague this past April, called for a world without nuclear weapons, even if it was targeted at the distant future. Japan has fully supported this particular idea for many decades. However, translating the idea into reality is always difficult enough all the time. Today, apart from the mere question of reducing the number of nuclear weapons, we are facing a variety of new challenges, including Iranian and North Korean issues, danger of nuclear terrorism, etc., etc., etc. Just yesterday, at the General Assembly of United Nations, Japan and the United States jointly proposed a disarmament resolution at the first Committee on Disarmament. U.S. supported Japan's proposal for 8 years' absence this time. However, North Korea and India vetoed. China, France, Israel, Myanmar, Pakistan, Cuba, and Britain abstained from voting. We are facing lots of new challenges. Now let me invite our distinguished presenters. We have Mr. David Albright. Oh, excuse me. He is president of the Institute for Science and International Security here in Washington, D.C. He worked for the IAEA Action Team in the 90s. He also worked as senior staff scientist at the Federation of American Scientists, as well as a member of research staff at the Princeton University Center for Energy and Environmental Studies, and published numerous works on this particular topic. And Professor Akiyama is from Hitotsubashi University in Tokyo. He has an adjunct post as a research fellow at the Center for the Promotion of Disarmament and Nonproliferation at the Japan Institute of International Affairs, and one of the leading experts on today's particular topic in Japan and the world. Please let me invite Mr. Albright first.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here today. It's always challenging to kind of leap from the world of nuclear nonproliferation into the world of nuclear energy. And it, just as a little bit of background, ISIS for the last several years has really focused primarily on proliferation, Iran, North Korea, Pakistan, India. We haven't done very much work on nuclear energy per se. In the past, we used to evaluate worldwide inventories of fissile material, either funded by foundations or by our national laboratories. And in that context, we would study essentially every program in the world that was generating plutonium, highly enriched uranium, or in the latter part of the project, neptunium and americium. And so in the distant past, I certainly looked quite closely at the Japanese nuclear program and many other civil nuclear programs in Europe. And we would try to focus on, as I said, on nuclear explosive material. And so some of that will come into this talk today, although I will say that I'm going to slant it toward the proliferation and what nuclear energy looks like, or particularly, nuclear power looks like from the perspective of someone who spends their days dealing with nonproliferation, or I should say, unfortunately, dealing with proliferation. And let me just start by, you know, how does proliferation occur as we see it at ISIS? And that it's largely by acquiring wherewithal overseas. We don't see any indigenous programs anymore. In fact, we'd argue there were very few to begin with, maybe the United States, but we depended on foreign scientists to a great extent. And if you go from there, you just see various efforts, some quite extensive, some less so, depending on overseas acquisition. And it's happened in broad terms in two different ways, through legitimate nuclear cooperation. I mean, a classic example would be India's Cirrus reactor that was acquired from Canada and then became the source of plutonium for their first nuclear explosive. We also see it through illicit methods, which seems to be the primary method today and has been for a couple decades. Good example is AQ Khan in Pakistan, but also if you look at the Iraqi program, heavily dependent on overseas procurement, illicit in many cases, but often secret. We see Iran continuing that tradition today, very dependent on acquiring things overseas for its gas centrifuge program, and we believe also for its Iraq reactor, heavy water reactor. Also, we see battlegrounds. And for us, as I mentioned, the key battlegrounds are really Iran and North Korea. And I think the outcome of those situations will have a big impact on proliferation in the future, whether we're going to enter a kind of a more golden era where maybe we'll even have fewer nuclear weapon states, or we're going to see a real stress over the possibilities of additional states seeking nuclear weapons, particularly in the Middle East. And it's, if you follow the news, which I know you all do, it's very hard to predict how Iran's going to end up at this point, or North Korea. One, from my point of view, one very positive development is President Obama has brought back nuclear disarmament in a big way. And so I don't see Iran or North Korea making decisions, despite North Korean statements, making decisions on whether there's an active trend toward nuclear disarmament. It certainly helps, I think, the effort to stop the spread of nuclear weapons around the world, and is it's long overdue that it became a central issue again. One thing I'd like to point out, again, this is an ISIS perspective, but I think it's shared, that the spread of, and it's very specific, the spread of turnkey modern nuclear power plants has had little stimulating effect on proliferation. And for some that, not in this room, may be an irony, but we found that if it's used wisely, that the provision of turnkey light water reactors can actually discourage proliferation, and I point to North Korea and Iran as two examples, and that these reactors become alternatives to, in essence, something far worse, if you want to say every reactor is a proliferation risk. And they also, by their provision, integrate these countries, these very nationalistic programs, into an international community, and they get a set of incentives not to proliferate. And also, I think you can safeguard these reactors much more effectively than you can the alternatives. Now, key to these arrangements in North Korea and Iran has been an insistence on permanent or temporary suspension of reprocessing and enrichment. I mean, Bushehr is an exception, obviously. And associated with these arrangements is one, spent fuel take-back schemes, and also assurances of fresh fuel. And Iran, I think, will, in its current with its current policies in this very hard-to-define regime, probably will never accept fuel assurances of any type. And I think we're seeing this played out with this very generous, kind of clever offer to provide or to take Iran's kind of zero economic value, low enriched uranium, enrich it further, and provide fuel for their research reactor, fuel they haven't been able to get since the early 90s. And yet they're raising inside Iran all kinds of opposition to that deal, including that if we give them the low-enriched uranium, we'll never get the fuel back, which is highly unlikely unless there's a war. Although, you know, that's happened before. But nonetheless, if Iran is willing to risk almost nothing, it can get fuel for its research reactor. Now, the real catch in proliferation is, how do you generalize these approaches? I mean, I think in proliferation, cases can be worked on pretty effectively. I mean, you don't always win, but you can develop a strategy. But the real problem comes up when you try to generalize them, and I'm going to start that process, maybe leave it to my colleague to expand upon, and then we can discuss this. And it also becomes a lot more controversial. Let me start with the Middle East, where we do quite a bit of work, and we look at who could proliferate, what are the chances, how would they do it. And I think nuclear power plants being inserted in there right now are a symbol of a country establishing a nuclear weapons capability. I mean, I think it's irrational, but then many things in the Middle East are irrational. And so what do you add to that? If you're going to provide nuclear power plants, what do you add? And I think it's fairly obvious. One is, you look for a commitment by that country that's going to receive the power plant that they'll have no domestic reprocessing or enrichment. UAE's been willing to go down that path. Turkey hasn't so far. Egypt hasn't. So it's a tough one, but nonetheless, I think it's important to insist upon that if reactors are going to be provided. Another is that the additional protocol has to be accepted. And I would argue, well, I'll come back to that, but the country has to accept the additional protocol. Proliferation, unfortunately, does take place. And how do they do it? They don't sign the additional protocol. Look at Syria. Look at Libya. Look at Iran. I mean, it's a no-brainer that if you stay with traditional safeguards, you can safely build undeclared sites. You may get caught eventually. Syria suffered quite a consequence. But there's a lot of this just in nick of time if you don't have robust inspections in these countries to provide transparency. Another aspect of supply should be the return of the spent fuel assurances, and also just a NSG commitment not to supply enrichment or technology into the region. And so here's from our point of view at ISIS, an attempt to try to generalize this. It's certainly deeply opposed by many in the Middle East, not least among Turkey, Egypt, Syria, I go down the list. But we see it as the kind of conditions that we should be striving for. And that's why I think also UAE was so important, even though I don't think anyone worries about UAE proliferating. But if you couldn't get it there, you had no chance of getting it anywhere else. And so that was the first test of this kind of approach. More general terms, and this gets back to my days at Princeton, I think. Used to be called the anti-plutonium mafia by some in the 80s when this controversy was a lot more spun up. But I think that as a matter of policy, countries with reprocessing and enrichment should discourage additional reprocessing and enrichment. And again, if that obviously applies, is that a question or just saying hi? But that it's an important position to take, and it's an important policy to have. I'm happy to discuss it later. I don't want to dwell too much on it now. But in proliferation, you do need, or in fighting proliferation, you need to have that in your back pocket. It's extremely important. And I could conceive of a situation with Taiwan. Taiwan moves to reprocess. That could make China very nervous based on what Taiwan has done in the past. And so long as we live in a world where there are tensions that can spill over into military conflicts, I think we have to have a policy like that at the government level. A related point, then, is what to do with spent fuel, and others have talked about that and can talk about it better than I. In a way, I can just complain. I mean, for these kinds of things to work, there's got to be a place to move the spent fuel. And each time it's come up, it's been unbelievably laborious to find a place to move, and I'm thinking now of research reactor fuel, taking out the Russian-supplied irradiated spent fuel out of Iraq. I mean, it had to become public, and suddenly Britain couldn't do it, or France. And it's a small amount of research reactor fuel, and Russia took it. But you have this fundamental problem of how to take the spent fuel out of these countries where you don't want them to develop, and I'll use an old term from some of our opponents, a plutonium mine. A plutonium supply on the surface in spent fuel that becomes easier and easier to reprocess as time goes on. Another issue is IA safeguards. And I mentioned that if you don't accept the additional protocol, it's proven that you can build undeclared facilities. And you have, and then we have to turn to the intelligence agencies' luck of having a defector come out to find these places. And so I think it's long overdue that the additional protocol should be a condition of supply, and the NSG should adopt that, and certainly countries should adopt that as a policy. Now, obviously, Russia, China are the big problems, and that argues for work at the NSG. But it's absolutely necessary. And for example, Syria, by not coming clean, certainly sends a signal that it hasn't stopped. It's just biding its time. And we know very little about how it got that reactor. I mean, it used smuggling, its own smuggling networks. It had North Korean help. And it's hard to track down how they got the components. And it's not a sophisticated reactor by any means. But where did the graphite come from? It's over 500 tons. Was it flown from North Korea? Would it come by boat? Did it come from China? I mean, I probably know this. There's no distinction between nuclear grade and regular graphite anymore, because the way it's produced. So it's a dual-use commodity that's easier to obtain. And so it may be, and Syria hasn't admitted the IA to look at least 3 to 4 or 5 sites, one of which had an indicator of possible fuel fabrication or fuel. I mean, the uranium was discovered at the reactor site that looks like it had a metal origin, but not a metal origin from an anti-Israeli tank or armor piercing. Looks like potentially a fuel element. So again, Syria doesn't accept the additional protocol. There's really no pressure on it to accept it. The IA didn't even demand a special inspection. And I think that there has to be a much deeper commitment to having robust intrusive inspections if countries that are in regions of tension are going to pursue nuclear energy more. The last thing I'll mention is, where is nuclear power heading? And that I look to you all. I think at ISIS, we don't really participate in the debate of, will Renaissance happen, will it not? Others in our community do, like Charles. But I think what we see is that we'd like to see a day when there is such a thing as a proliferation-proof fuel cycle. And so we support research toward that direction. And we also support the U.S. actively participating in the international efforts to try to make that happen. We won't go as far as saying we should reprocess here. We would be opposed to that. Wouldn't see the purpose, to be honest. And it would undercut the idea of being against reprocessing spreading further. And again, I say that carefully. I'm not against it, and we're not at ISIS against it spreading further in Britain, France, China, Japan. I mean, we're not trying to fight that battle. but we'll make exceptions too. Enrichment in Brazil, we deeply opposed it in the 80s and worked to try to get it safeguarded and stopped, but essentially lost the battle in the Brazilian Congress. The Navy was just too powerful. But since then, haven't really taken a position against Brazilian enrichment. And ironically, some of the people I worked with in the Brazilian Physics Society who were deeply opposed to Brazilian enrichment, one of whom is heading the Atomic Energy Commission now and is deeply supportive of Brazilian enrichment. So, but in any case, I think it's important for the U.S. to participate in this because I don't, again, this is from our work a couple years ago, and someone can correct me, is we still see that there is a debate, probably economic more than anything, over if you're going to develop an advanced fuel cycle, do you separate out the actinides separately? You know, is it plutonium first, then neptunium, then americium, or is it all together and it's highly radioactive, and so that you have a cycle where that you're not separating out nuclear explosive materials, and we would not want to end up with just more nuclear explosive material with neptunium in fairly large quantities added to the separated inventories and sort of the same old proliferation problem. And let me just, I'm a little bit flippant here, but I'm simplifying, but it's you end up with a dangerous technology saddled with hard to implement institutional and political fixes, which I see as somewhat the dilemma facing the nonproliferation community as we strive to stop the spread of nuclear weapons. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much. My name is Nobu Akiyama. I'm teaching at Hitotsubashi University and also working as a research associate of the Japan Institute of International Affairs. Speaking in front of you is the big challenge in three folds for me. First of all, I see actually my academic advisor in front of me, and I'm feeling like I've been examined. And that's the first thing. And the second is I'm the last speaker of the panel, and it seems like, you know, all the things that I was trying to speak has already spoken by others, so I'm wondering what I should talk. And thirdly, the biggest challenge is that I put this the title, the Avoiding the Failure of Atoms for Peace. That is, I think, that could be a challenge to the policies of the United States, and I'm hoping this is a rather provocative the title, but I hope that this is not really giving really. I hope you don't feel bad about it. So the first slide, I think these data has already shown by the other people, so I skip. But the last line, that since 2005, more than 25 countries expressed interest in nuclear power. And this is a really important phenomena. And my following talk will be mostly focused on how this new phenomena will be affecting the sort of proliferation, non-proliferation trends from the institutional and political viewpoints. By train, I'm a sort of a political scientist and not the natural scientist, so I'm more or less interested in how the institutions, or policy institutions work or not work, and at the same time, how the regional dynamics of the countries where the countries of the concerns are located are the great interest of mine. So my presentation will focus on two things: institutions and politics. So let me show you some sort of the characteristics of the two regions: the Northeast Asia and the Middle East. Here, I sort of make a list of the countries in Northeast Asia with some characteristics of these countries' nuclear programs. So, of course, North Korea, it's keep on playing a dangerous nuclear game. And then China, this is a nuclear giant. It's emerging. And from a security perspective, of course, between U.S.-Japan alliance and China, it's got a sort of a program how to sort of reconcile kind of more stable relationship over nuclear deterrent or the seemingly stable strategic relationship. But at the same time, as far as the their nuclear industries and the fissile materials capabilities are concerned, we got the problems. We don't know how much does China have the fissile materials and other things, and that is a set of concern for us. Of course, Japan, we have some troubles, actually, to be frank, in the fuel cycle programs. And then from the outsider's viewpoint, probably the largest fuel cycle programs in non-nuclear weapon states and the largest stockpile of civil plutonium could be perceived as a kind of a concern in security matters. And South Korea, you know, in a previous session, we had a question, about the renewal of the Korea-U.S. Bilateral nuclear cooperation agreement. And in that process, there is an issue of whether or not the pyro processing would be accepted or not. And in my observation, it is really difficult for South Korea to pursue this technology. I think it's not likely that the U.S. government would give a consent on that. But still, with this, there is a rising politics over so-called nuclear sovereignty, and that is somewhat similar to the phenomena of kind of the politics over inalienable rights of Article 4 of NPT. And Taiwan, it also has a trouble in the storage of spent fuel. And I think some of you may remember that there was an incident that the Taiwan was almost shipping the spent fuel to South Korea and North Korea. And there, it's triggered a severe concerns on us whether or not what really should deal with the, how we should deal with the spent fuel in the region. So, the question is, Is the multilateral arrangement a solution to deal with such problems? And I see some sort of possibilities, and I will try to touch upon this later. And in Middle East, of course, Middle East is driven to the nuclear renaissance. And since 2006, more than a dozen of countries in the Middle East expressed interest in nuclear programs. But the problem is there is a prior record of adherence to safety, security, and safeguards rules. So this is the sort of diagram which I actually cited from Sharon Squassoni's the presentation. And then please look at the column of safeguards. This is the status of additional protocol. And many of the countries in the Middle East have not signed and ratified additional protocol. And I think this is a serious concern, and in a previous session, we had discussed the importance of additional protocol, and without the presence of such a kind of a stringent rule, it would be the potential serious sort of cause of troubles. Then, what are the driving factors for the nuclear renaissance? Of course, the countries in the region claims the economic and environmental factors such as increasing energy demand or saving some fossil fuels for the future economic growth or responding to climate change, or they need pure water. So desalination is one of the important cause of nuclear renaissance. But in the many people's view, it is kind of a response to the nuclear Iran. So this is the programs in the Middle East are sort of the programs to hedge the Iran, the rising nuclear Iran. First of all, in responding to the military threats, and also there are concerns on the regional rivalries. If in order to avoid Iran behaving as the hegemon in the region. And also, we have a factor of technological and political prestige related to the nuclear fuel cycle. So then, what types of proliferation concerns exist in the civil use? Of course, diversion, and I need to correct this, not can do, but it's a Cyrus reactor in India. and the concealing the military activities, in particular procurements of the materials and the technologies behind the sort of legitimate reasons of civil use. That is another concern. And third is the withdrawal. So I really would like to stress that third point, because that actually is the outcome of sort of the problems, the deficiencies of existing non-proliferation regime. So that point, I would like to touch upon some institutional deficiencies. So IAEA safeguard system is not perfect, actually far from perfect, I would say. First of all, additional protocol is not the sort of obligatory the rule. So if you want to sign, you can sign. But if you don't want, you are not really forced to sign and ratify. And I think so far we got probably approximately 90 countries that ratified, but it's less than half of the countries in this world. And we need more sort of efforts to sort of encourage other countries to ratify and implement additional protocol, because as we have discussed earlier, additional protocol is a very effective way to have a more intrusive access to not only to the other nuclear site, but as well as the some suspicious places or sites. So I think this is important, but that we haven't yet to reach the point that we have a high confidence on the effectiveness of additional protocol yet. And the second concern is we have no way of assessing the intentions and the rationalities of the nuclear activities. In an extreme case, for example, we got the nuclear reactors here, and we don't have an energy grid plugged into the nuclear plant. Then, but still, we have to say, as long as it's under safeguards, it's a legitimate activities. But, you know, in many cases, such as in Iran, we don't see any rationalities. In the case of Iran, they have developed enrichment facilities first, and they didn't have the fuel fabrication facilities. Then, from the viewpoint of energy security, in my view, because plutonium market is so stable, if I were in a position of Iran, I would develop the fuel fabrication program for the facility first in order to secure the fuel supply. But because you cannot use uranium as it is, so but then we see them so suspicious. But as far as the safeguard system is concerned, we are not really able to conclude that they have a clear intention of diversion of programs into military purposes. Then the second is vulnerable infrastructure and security and personnel management in many countries. As you know, the most serious concern is, of course, in Pakistan. But at the same time, in Japan, we had a case that Iranian students studied in a university on the nuclear technologies, in particular some technology related to the reprocessing. And so we need to have sort of the control on the deemed export. Then sadly, as a nature of technology, any cutting-edge technology becomes obsolete or so widespread. We are not really able to control the flow of knowledge. And also, the economic incentives sometimes override the regulations, the rules of export controls. As the Dr. Suzuki mentioned earlier, even among the Japanese companies, they are really not so proudly. It's not the record is not so proud, good enough. And some small and medium-sized the trading companies are shipping sensitive materials to the countries, which is a kind of the sort of points for leading into the market of North Korea, and that is, I think, the somewhat we may have to really seriously think about. And of course, we have a political and security environment, as we have seen in the case of Middle East. many countries could be driven to the nuclear program by some security and political concerns. The furthermore, in related to the nuclear renaissance, we have additional concerns. When the competition for the market will be intensified, what happened? You may compete for the price, but of course, price is not only the factor. To what extent you are going to introduce stringent the rules for on the safety, security, and safeguards? And actually, the last month I visited Vienna and spoke with some people in IAEA, and I heard about the request from one company or country regarding setting up the stringent safety, security rules for exporting the nuclear reactors, because some designs of reactors actually have cut safety measures, and that provides some price competitiveness in price. But at the same time, if you are not going to introduce the stringent rules in these three S's, then that could be another criteria for competition. For example, if Japan tell the other countries that unless you are not going to introduce the additional protocol, we are not able to ship the materials from Japan, then if the other country comes, like for example, okay, but we don't care about the additional protocol as long as we can do business with you. You know, you are happy to export. Then it's obvious which partner you will choose. And that is actually happening, I think, in my view. So that is one thing we have to really remember. And the second is the rising nuclear sovereignty question. Of course, aspiration for nuclear technology as a symbol of industrialized, advanced country, that is the case. And also, through actually unfortunate discussion on the fuel cycle controls or multilateralization, there is kind of intensified politicization of the issue of inalienable rights. And that could be one of the major issues which could lead into the failure of NPT review conference next year. So then how we have been responding to these the proliferation concerns so far? Mostly I'd like to touch upon the three sort of institutional measures. One is bilateral control through like 1-2-3 agreements. That is maybe, in my view, the supplement to the safeguards of IAEA. And that is seen, I see this is kind of a Atoms for Peace version, Middle East, Atoms for Peace version, I don't know, something. Then, of course, they are attempting to strengthen the NSG guidelines, but so far it hasn't successful. Then another important the policy option is multilateralizing the fuel cycle control and providing assurance supplies. And seeing this, except the NSG guidelines, it's like a kind of back to the future phenomena. We have seen these attempts in the past, and we see some consequences. But anyway, this is a sort of my sort of a concept in my mind, how we are dealing with the security, proliferation threats. The institutional approaches and the technological approaches, like introducing the proliferation resistant technologies and verification safeguard technologies should be updated. But at the same time, we need to fill the gap. So that's incentive approaches. That's political and economic incentives. And the multilateral controls and the bilateral agreements are fall in the category somewhere in between incentive and institutional. Then we need to integrate three of these approaches into one in order to respond to the various proliferation concerns. Then I want to touch upon what we have learned from the past, in particular the Atoms for Peace. Of course, the first point is related to the multilateral fuel cycle approach. And then the biggest issue was during the 70s and 80s. It resulted, unfortunately, in reiteration of the inalienable rights. So that means, in the end, after the lengthy discussion on that, we had to acknowledge the rights to to develop the indigenous or national fuel cycle programs. And actually, Japan was one of the beneficiaries of that, but still, as far as from the viewpoint of proliferation, this could be a concern. Then what about Atoms for Peace? In my judgment, Atoms for Peace is Atoms for Alliance, or the managing the relationship with countries. So, because Japan is the closest ally to the United States, I think United States gave a special status to us. You know, we host only single sort of marine base in abroad, station abroad, and also we got sort of a huge scale of U.S. Troops in Japan, and our sort of a relationship, security relationship, is so tight. So I think that's one of the sort of a reason behind that, the fact that we are granted a special status. But depending on the relationship with the United States, I think the level of freedom on activities are different. So even in Northeast Asia, Korea was not granted a status of developing its own fuel cycle. That is a huge difference. It's probably the difference between the relationships, bilateral relationships. But what happened to the Atoms for Peace, by the way, we have to definitely need to look at it. You know, after the Atoms for Peace, United States has changed into the more focus on the bilateral relationship, bilateral cooperations. Of course, Atoms for Peace is designed to create a multilateral, multilateral control, but it failed. Then the U.S. had concluded more than 50 bilateral agreements in 2 years, 55 and 56. Then what was the result? Then there could be a possibility of proliferation between third parties. U.S. could control the activities with the U.S. origin materials and technologies, but then the United States cannot control the third-party transactions. That is a sort of an institutional deficit or deficiencies of this bilateral control. Then, of course, we have bilateral arrangements spread the seeds of proliferation by transferring the technologies. That's more important element. Then with this, we see the pros and cons of American 123 agreements. And pros, of course, we can get the political commitment by recipient countries for the refraining from pursuing a national nuclear fuel cycle in exchange for assurance of supply. Then, but programs are, first of all, there is no legal requirement of ratification additional protocol. As I mentioned, the additional protocol is an important measure for the more intrusive inspections and possibly supplemented by a more stringent United Nations Security Council resolution or something. But the existence of additional protocol arrangement is quite important. Then this 123 agreement is not applied to the transaction of these recipient countries with third parties. That even if United States could withdraw their cooperation, U.S. cooperation with that country, then if third party could fill in that gap, there will be no way that we can really stop it. So that's what we have to really think about. And then also the question is the universal applicability of the 123 agreement. Probably India is okay, UAE is okay, but what about Egypt? What about other countries which are not really willing to ratify additional protocol and with some sort of a past record of suspected the nuclear development? Then what about the multilateral approaches? Of course, it could at least provide one of the criteria of proof of non-interest in a military diversion. The participating into the multilateral approach itself provides a sign that this country is not interested in the military activities. And then we are able to strengthen the cooperation among like-minded countries, which could lead into the strengthening of international non-proliferation norms. But once again, the problems are, first of all, it remains as a voluntary arrangement because of a very strong resistance by the countries related to the inalienable right of NPT. Then it is the sort of the things that if that is the case, then the time in the proliferators would not join because of this Article 4. Then probably we cannot punish the countries not joining the arrangement. It's so difficult because as long as it remains a voluntary arrangement. Then the second problem is that without take-back arrangement for the spent fuel, maybe it cannot be an attractive offer for countries with small-size nuclear programs. Then can the United States really take back the program, not fuel, which is provided by the United States? The answer so far is no. Then how can you make sure that, you know, you got really safe, I mean, you got really attractive fuel management? So the challenges ahead for us, the alliance, the U.S.-Japan alliance, I would say that we need a ground rule. We have to pursue sort of universal rules and regulations in the area of 3Ss. And that is not only in the purpose of the non-proliferation, but also it could provide the venue for setting a level playing field for American and Japanese nuclear industries. As I mentioned earlier, United States and Japan probably are the countries with more stringent rules for introduction of non-proliferation areas. So with these countries may choose whether or not they are going to cooperate with Japanese industries or not. And then if you have more attractive offers without stringent introduction of the non-proliferation rules, and if the price is the same, which you're going to choose? So we, for the purpose of the industries of our countries, we have to pursue this universalization of the rules of 3Ss. Then, secondly, we also need to consider about the intentions of the countries trying to introduce the nuclear programs. So we have to try to introduce some rules for increasing the transparencies and accountabilities in nuclear programs and industry. And for that purposes, even though I was not so optimistic, but the multilateral fuel cycle control could play some role. And further challenges ahead. Of course, the motivations behind the nuclear programs are mostly deriving from the security concerns. And in some countries and in some regions. So that's the kind of root cause of proliferation. We have to address that. And these security challenges must be dealt with in a coordinated manner between the United States and Japan. Then finally, beyond the rally around the flag or show the flag. The show the flag is a sort of the famous phrase, supposedly made by Rich Armitage when the Japanese are reluctant to providing some support in Iraq, I think. But then that means sort of some sign that Japan should more work together for work on the international peace cooperation and so forth. But that's also maybe kind of a reluctant, showing the reluctance of Japanese cooperating in that. But so we have to go beyyond that kind of attitude. We have to play a leading role in setting these the sort of universal criteria for safety, security, and safeguards. And also, it shouldn't be simply blinded support on the nuclear fuel cycle. We have to be very sober and rational, and we have to think really about the pros and cons, and we have to think about how to overcome the problems of the fuel cycle. But for that, I think the United States have to reestablish its leadership role, in particular in multilateral forum. And the U.S.-Japan Global Partnership must be redefined and also have a clear strategy how two countries really can cooperate for the sort of shared objectives. And finally, as I mentioned, we have to avoid serious politics over inalienable rights and avoid the divide between nuclear haves and nuclear have-nots, which might be created by these new mechanisms. So then what can Japan play a role? That would be the question that maybe I want to throw to you, what Japan can or what the United States can do for that. Thank you very much.
One of the priority areas. Now the floor is open. Who is ready to have weapon-grade questions? Okay, gentlemen over there. Yes.
To Mr. Akiyama, how do you see the new Japanese government?
Identify yourself?
Hugh Grindstaff, and recently retired from National Geographic. How do you see the U.S. government, the new Japanese government, dealing with your proposal about there's a shift supposedly in U.S.-Japan relations, maybe? It's being reviewed? Thank you.
Shall we maybe collect a couple of questions? Our lady over there.
Thank you. Jennifer Mackby from CSIS. I was wondering about the additional protocol and the linkage, as you know, probably with Article 6, because there are a number of countries, such as Egypt and others, who will refuse to sign on to the additional protocol unless further progress is made in nuclear disarmament. You probably know the story, and especially regarding the Middle East. Thank you.
Charles Ebinger Brookings. I'd like to ask Dr. Albright if he thinks the U.S.-India nuclear deal was good for nonproliferation or whether it sent the wrong message.
Professor Gellin, please start.
Thank you very much. Regarding the policy of new governments, actually, we are not sure yet. I think they are now busy in handling with the base issue and also the budget formulation, and we haven't really heard about their ideas on what they should deal with non-proliferation aspect. And as far as foreign ministry is concerned, there's not the political level, but the bureaucrats level concerned. I mean, that's somewhat related to the question on the additional protocol as a condition for the bilateral arrangement with Japan. I think that's the case, and we have introduced the ground rule that the Japanese government will sign the bilateral nuclear cooperation agreements with the countries which have signed and ratified the additional protocol. So in the case of a Japan-UAE agreement, I think Japanese government is waiting the UAE government to ratify additional protocol. So I think that line would be maintained, and even I see, the more sort of a stringent the non-proliferation policy would be introduced. In particular, the export controls, and of course, I think government is trying to make sort of political and diplomatic efforts for introducing the amendment of these NSG guidelines, and so forth. But these are, I think, along the line of the past, and I don't see any sort of new elements. And on the linkage between Article 6 and additional protocol, I think this is the typical sort of politicization of the articles of NPTs. To me, these are the totally different issues. And of course, we understand the concerns of Middle Eastern countries related to the Israeli nuclear capabilities and, of course, Iran's to some extent. But then it's rather irrational if they say this would be the reason why they are not really going to sign additional protocol. And
But at the same time, we understand the security concerns without proper security guarantees or provided to the countries in the region, they may consider some rooms for the, left for the nuclear options. Then I remember in July or something, I think Secretary Clinton mentioned actually possibility of providing nuclear umbrella to the countries in the Middle East, I think in a town meeting in Jakarta or something. And so venue is somewhat strange, and that record was not in the homepage of State Department. So I guess this is not yet the official policy of the government, but still, the question is actually, this is hypothetical, but if they are provided this kind of security assurances like that, then are they going to give up their nuclear, this national sort of nuclear program? Then my guess is probably no, and because it's somewhat related to the nuclear prestige. And, but I'm sure that issue would be a major problem for the upcoming review conference. And if the review conference would be to fail, that is, I think, one of the important the factors.
Yeah, let me revisit a little bit on the additional protocol and linkages to Article 6 in the Middle East. I mean, they're profound, unfortunately, and they are political. So I think the strategy to deal with it is twofold. One is to try to break the linkage, that if you want a nuclear power plant, you have to have the additional protocol, simple as that. And it's a big chore, but I think that's the way forward on that. The other is start dealing with the question of a nuclear weapons-free zone in the Middle East, which is at the heart of this concern of Egypt. And I think it's very important for the United States to make this a priority. And what does it mean in the short term? It means getting the CTBT and the Fissile Material Cutoff Treaty. And I think those are two arms control treaties that Israel would have a very hard time resisting. They would like to see those treaties, particularly the FMCT, come into play much later in the process of seeking a nuclear weapons-free zone. But I think that they can be pressured, if that's the right word, to accept it earlier. And I think that's, unfortunately, probably the necessary way to deal with this question of Egypt. I'm trying to avoid this. I always have a block. U.S.-India. Let me be flip. You know, if you're going to make a mistake, do it right. So that's sort of my attitude toward the U.S.-India deal. And so what I would look to India for now is help on Iran, significant help on Iran. I think it may be forthcoming. Help on illicit trade. India has horribly implemented export controls. It's a place of growing interest from European, U.S. high-tech suppliers. It's very easy for countries to set up turntable operations in India right now. Wouldn't it be ironic if Pakistan uses India as a turntable to get illicitly equipment for its gas centrifuge program? But right now, India is vulnerable. It's had horrible security over its information, nuclear information. But nonetheless, we can, I think, expect help, and I think they'll take help on improving their situation. And then also, I think, look to India for help on the growing divide on this issue of the inalienable right of nuclear energy, and hope that India can provide somewhat of a bridge on that issue.
Who else has questions? Yes, please.
Charles Ferguson, Council on Foreign Relations. So I'm going to take my colleague, Professor Akiyama's last slide and his question about what role can Japan play, and turn it back to him, and specifically on two areas. That one area he really talked about a lot was additional protocol. So my question is, if we're facing dilemma, Professor Akiyama outlined, and I think he's correct, that countries that have a choice of going with a supplier that demands additional protocol and one that does not, they would choose the one that does not, because it seems there's a lower price to be paid. So one question in the area is, so why did Japan sign up to additional protocol? Why have certain countries ratified it and gone through with it and others have not? What have you seen? What do you think you're gaining by doing that? It may be an obvious answer, but I'd like to hear it stated for the record. And then, what incentives can Japan and others who have actually gone through that process offer
to make this universal. And then the final question on Iran, what role can Japan play there? I mean, right now we have this so-called P5 plus one process, and so Germany is a player there, and we want Japan to be a more active player in nonproliferation. And I'm a strong supporter, I said last week in Tokyo, of Japan getting a permanent seat on the UN Security Council. So how can Japan then take a more leadership role in this vital area right now in trying to stop Iran from getting nuclear weapons? And by doing so, then really demonstrate Japan is ready to step up to a permanent seat on the Security Council.
Thank you very much. Actually, the first question, seemingly easy, but I think really difficult if you think in a somewhat philosophical way. Because if you have a choice of the market or the partners of business, you know, it's rational to choose the easier one. And then even with you have a choice of an easier one, then how come you can choose a difficult one, like, you know, with a sort of additional protocol? I think, I don't know, as a political scientist, if I employ this theory of the sort of constructivism, then that's norm matters. And then maybe more simply, countries do not want to be regarded as a suspect of a proliferation. And eventually it could lead into some sort of obstacle for doing more business with countries with high concerns on the non-proliferation. And coincide with the size of market like Japan or the United States. So, and for example, in the case of Kazakhstan and Russia, Japan is trying to establish trilateral cooperation in order to get the uranium from Kazakhstan. And we need the plants. We need to use the plants in Russia. So we have a bilateral agreement with Kazakhstan, with Russia, and in which, in the process of the negotiation, I think we also requested the Kazakhstan to ratify the additional protocol, and the Kazakhstan did, I think because the offer is quite attractive. And also our technology is probably somewhat attractive to Russians. So if we have more attractive offers, then we have some sort of incentive for them to ratify additional protocol. So the assumption is if conditions are the same, then we choose the easier one. But if these conditions, or more, we can offer more attractive in terms of technology and other matters, then we can encourage. And also the norms matters. Then secondly, that's somewhat related to incentives, right? And then as for Iran, what Japan can play a role in the case of Iran? Well, I think my understanding is that the role of that Japan can play will be limited. But at least we can provide the sort of details of Japan model. The Iranians always claim that they are following the Japan model. It's a non-nuclear weapon state with the full fuel cycle program. But that two falls. One is Japan doesn't have a complete closed fuel cycle. Some elements of the fuel cycle must be relied on the foreign services, and that's one thing. So we are somewhat already internationalized to some extent. Secondly, Japan model is not about the fuel cycle, but about the compliance with IAEA safeguards. And of course, from the expert's viewpoint, we got some questions over the perfection of the application of additional sort of safeguards. But still, we are probably mostly in full compliance with additional the safeguards, including application of integrated safeguards. So I would like to tell the Iranians that if you claim the Japan model, you have to make application of integrated safeguard to their programs. Unless they are doing so, then they shouldn't have rights to claim the Japan model.
You know, let me be a little heavy-handed. I'm going to turn in your question a little bit, but I mean, one thing that I would like to see is Japan playing more of a role in imposing sanctions on Iran. In conjunction, and not in the Security Council, but in conjunction with the United States and the European Union. I think it can be very useful. I know it's hard. Another is, I think Japan's done a wonderful job of improving its ability to stop illicit trade. I mean, we know Iran operates out of North Asia when it can. I mean, it's used South Korea's turntables. It certainly uses China. Iran likes the higher, better quality equipment for its nuclear program. And so I think Japan's really done a lot on that and also trying to thwart sales to North Korea. One whimsical thing I would like to see is the Japanese government say that, and other governments, that the IAEA cannot do its job without the additional protocol. I mean, if you read the IAEA safeguards report on Iran, they essentially say it every 3 months. And I think it would be interesting to have it stated by the Japanese government and then by the next director general that just can't do our job without the additional protocol. And if that's what the world wants, then fine.
1 point about the sanction. Actually, one time I took part in the sort of the team of examining the options of economic sanction vis-à-vis Iran, which is handled by Foreign Ministry. And then after reviewing various policy tools, actually we have pretty much limited tools for imposing sanctions, also the area of the sanctions. And I think the most effective way is to stop the sort of foreign currency in a transaction and so forth, but that was probably impossible. And trade between Japan and Iran at the time is already low enough not to to have a sort of significant impact in decision-making in Iran. And of course, we need to give some negative sanctions, but at the same time, at some stage that Iran expressed the interest in engaging with this EU 3+3, then we may be able to provide further sort of incentives. And maybe that's Japan can play, but as far as sort of negative sanctions concerned, I think tools are limited.
Can I say one thing? I mean, one thing that's been helpful in Europe is for governments to take a policy to discourage business with Iran. I mean, it has much more play in Germany, which has huge amounts of business. But as a policy, it's helpful.
Okay, gentleman here, and then lady over there.
Pete Sprunger, AAAS. GE and Hitachi have just started up a laser enrichment facility. I was wondering if you could comment on what that could mean if that technology turns out to be viable. What would that do for proliferation?
Hi, thank you. Sharon Squassone from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Dr. Akiyama, I really loved your chart, which had the integrated approach. But it got me thinking, especially the fact that Japan has on a national basis now adopted the additional protocol as a condition of supply, that we can't let up the pressure on doing this all at three levels, multinational, national, and maybe even industry. But it seems to me that, you know, a few multinational approaches isn't going to work, precisely because of what you described as the increasing politicization of this debate about inalienable rights. So I would like to ask you, and maybe David also, how do we get to complete multinationalization, at least of the sensitive parts of the fuel cycle, enrichment and reprocessing? I have a hunch that we would need to move through a legal route, maybe using the cutoff treaty as a way to level the playing field for all existing and future facilities, but I'd like to hear your views.
I've been asked to deal with the laser enrichment question. And any time a technology is proven to be simple to replicate, if you have the classified information, it poses a big risk. I mean, that's really the problem with the gas centrifuge. If you're on your own, if Iran was on its own, it never would have built one, but it had incredible amounts of assistance. So I would probably apply that same criteria to laser enrichment. If it turns out that it's quite feasible, developed, and people can get their hand on the classified literature associated with it, it could become a real problem. But I think our view at ISIS is that we need to study it more. I mean, and it should be done in the U.S. context. Japan could do it too, but to look at the proliferation implications of this technology, particularly with an eye to what happened with gas centrifuges and a few other technologies that were thought to be too advanced to spread, unlike reprocessing. Let me end it there. I've answered your question. You can answer, Cher, and I'm curious.
Thank you. I thought that the Dr. Albright would respond to the Sharon's question, so I wasn't really preparing for the answer. But my observation is that unless we make this multilateral arrangement a legal obligation, it's very totally impossible to have to achieve universalization of participation into this the multilateral arrangement. But so my thought is that's why we have to have sort of supplementary sort of various layered approaches, including pursuing the universalization of additional protocol and introducing this multilateral fuel cycle approaches, and also even this bilateral arrangement is important. And then we have to have two sort of different approaches. One is sort of punitive. The other one is kind of providing incentives, and which is sort of more effective. I think I would say the punitive one is more effective. And how can we make it possible? In that respect, we have discussed earlier that the role that the United Nations Security Council could play is important. So, we are not able to assess the intentions, but at least we can guess the intentions. And if they have some suspicious activities, and without the additional protocol ratification, we should try to argue whether more sort of enforceable, intrusive inspections could be possible through the United Nations Security Council resolutions. Of course, this is very difficult, and of course, as you correctly pointed out, politicization over the inalienable rights still once again comes up to the issue when we talk about the UN Security Council resolution. But I think this is one of the venues that we may try to look into more sort of feasibilities of.
Thank you very much. Well, can I take just one brief question? The gentleman over there.
Thanks. How about one and a half? I'm Bruce Lauder, formerly of the Department of Energy, now independent. I had to step out briefly. You may have covered it, but with the NPT review conference coming up, what do you see as the emerging objectives of the concerned states, and how likely will they be able to achieve those at the conference? And the next is, there was a brief discussion about incentives, and of course the Bush administration was very actively involved in trying to incentivize positive behavior through various your ATOM, Generation 4 International Forum, R&D efforts, and its flagship program, the Global Nuclear Energy Partnership. Congress and then the administration pretty much gutted and ended the domestic component of GNEP and shifted to long-range R&D and probably never looked that favorably on the international side, although it's still continuing. I'm just wondering what impact that has had on the U.S. credibility abroad in trying to positively shape the inevitable expansion of nuclear power along peaceful paths.
Would you answer briefly?
I must say I was never very favorable toward the domestic part of that, so I'm probably in the category you're talking about. I do support the international. I think it's important that the U.S. play a strong leadership role in trying to shape how the fuel cycle develops in the longer term. Unfortunately, I think in the shorter to midterm that we're faced with what we have, and it's a, unfortunately from a proliferation point of view, sort of essentially a risky technology. And that, I think, is going to suck up or absorb a lot of the attention. And I hope it doesn't distract from the longer term. But I think what you're talking about is ultimately a lot of these shorter term things, concerns wipe out the more thoughtful longer term. But I would hope with the Obama administration that they would continue trying to shape the future of the fuel cycle, generally supportive of nuclear power reactors growing in number, and that we would find another balance on that issue. Do you want to deal with the NPT thing?
Thank you. On the NPT, you know, my response is I'm not sure what my response will directly respond to your question, but the thing is how to deal with the sort of concerns countries like Iran or the future potential sort of concerns. I think one of the issue, key issues that we have to deal with during the NPT review conference is that whether or not we can really introduce the some rules for the or stringent interpretation of Article 10. And if we are able to introduce some interpretation of Article 10, which makes more difficult for countries to withdraw, then there will be a more incentive for the compliance. And because under the, you know, the possibility of being sanctioned under the law, international law will be increased. And that would be one of the measures that could, which could prevent the potential proliferators or concerned states from attempting some sort of suspicious or activities. And on the second point that the United States can play a role, that's also related to the U.S.-Japan cooperation, but another area is, although it may not be a mainstream, but we can set a kind of a de facto standard on the more proliferation-resistant technologies in a sort of nuclear reactor design or safeguards technologies and so forth. And that kind of area is, that kind of issues or the items are maybe somewhat important for the international corporations.
Thank you very much. I know you still have many questions, but unfortunately, time is up. I hope today's event triggered for the next stage of fruitful discussions between Washington and Tokyo, particularly in this field of nuclear questions, both in industrial and security aspects. Both nations bear huge responsibilities for the coming generations. Thank you very much for your attendance, distinguished guests. Please let me join to thank our excellent panelists.